Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and
Hello.
welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I am joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
Well, I'm here at last. My apologies for delaying this entire process, but I'm fine. I'm glad it's a Friday, I guess.
Indeed, indeed. It's the sweetest day of the week because not even 1 minute of the weekend has yet passed. That's why Friday afternoon is the best part of the whole week. We're also joined today by Ofense Davey. Ofense, how are you doing, sir?
I am well, thank you. Yes, it's finally Friday and here we are still working while everyone else has probably started their weekend.
Yes, well, one tend to hope so. Although I'm sure there's some people who are listening to this live, and apologies for being very late today on the live, but that's our bad. That I'm sure there's still people plugging away dutifully at work at 2 o'clock on Friday, even though it is the worst time to be working because you can smell the weekend in the air. But let's not sidetrack too much with that. So, what are we going to talk about today? Well, we're just going to do a little perusal of policy, politics, landscape in South Africa right now. Let's start off with talking a little bit about Grade R, or as they used to call it when I was in school, Grade Naught. And this is something that was introduced as compulsory for all schools to offer in the Bella Bill. The Bella Bill, which gave this expanded amount of power to provincial administrators, basically, to control many policies of schools related to admissions and language, for example. That was controversial, and we've talked about that on the show before. But the thing that was regarded probably the least controversially by everyone about the Bella Bill, and what I think pretty much everyone agrees was probably a good idea, was the inclusion of Grade R or Grade Zero as a compulsory part of our kids' schooling. This is part of this realization that early childhood development is actually very important and that getting kids well situated in the early years has a lot more benefit than trying to fix the problems later. Well, it has emerged increasingly that the money for the envisioned compulsory Grade R is just simply not available. despite schools now basically being under legal obligation to offer Grade R, the Minister for Basic Education, the DA's Siwewe Gorube, says that the resources just aren't there in many schools to actually do this, particularly in places like Northern KwaZulu-Natal. A spokesperson for Gorube said the challenges are exacerbated by the fact that no additional funding was made available in the budget tabled in Parliament for additional costs associated with making Grade R compulsory, such as infrastructure, human resources, learning and teaching and support materials. The Gorube spokesperson said it's a challenging situation, but the minister will continue to support provinces to do their best with what is available. The education system is an unenviable position where it's facing serious financial constraints and must now find resources to comply with the law for compulsory Grade R. The minister wishes to make it clear that Grade R is essential, as confirmed by the Thrive by Five Index 2024 study findings. She is committed to ensuring that compulsory Grade R is rolled out and will continue to appeal to National Treasury for necessary funding for compulsory Grade R. Ofense, let me start with you. You know, unfortunately, this is a thing we see all the time in South Africa. We have these grand visions. Most infamously, of course, were the president's the State of the Nation promises of smart cities and high-speed trains and all that sort of thing that he made in, I think it was 2019. And we have these grand visions, but the basic building blocks are not there. The basic building blocks in terms of funding, the basic building blocks in terms of, you know, just having teachers to fill positions, of having qualified teachers, are not there. And so there's now this extra burden on what is, I think, I agree, is a good idea. Grade R should be compulsory. It's important to get kids into school very early so they can start learning. But man, it's kind of just depressing to see the minister basically saying, I'm just going to have to keep begging National Treasury for some money for this. What's your takeaway on this one?
Yeah, quite a lot to say about this. First of all, I'll start off with saying that besides our debt relief, the budget mostly budget mostly consists of education. Most of our budget goes to education. And in reading the story, I dug up an old statistic. And I dug up an old statistic which showed that in the medium term budget of 2021, it showed that 80% of that budget goes to paying salaries, and then the remaining 20 goes to the other things like goods and services, food schemes, and somewhere along there, infrastructure as well. And the infrastructure is what's the issue here that the minister has raised. So, yeah, cutting funding, especially for education, is never advised. And the fact that our education budget is the biggest in the world is also quite telling, that despite all the money we have, despite all the resources we're putting into it, our biggest crutch is the mismanagement of the funds and how it's being used, and the appropriation of funds as well within the Department of Education. Another thing is that with the Bella Act, it shows that how the government is, rather than trying to solve the issues of education, it believes that giving the government more power is the solution. So making grade R compulsory is the solution. And if grade R is not compulsory, that school is going against the law. With that, how would the government exactly enforce that? Is it the school's responsibility, or is it the responsibility of the parents to get their kids to grade R after they reach a certain age? So it's another issue of enforcement as well. Yes, the initiative is good. Kids should go to grade R, and it should be compulsory, but it's not tackling the underlying issues, the mismanagement of the education system, the lack of competency in the education system. Do we have the qualified teachers? Do we have the necessary infrastructure? Some schools don't even have water coming out of the taps. Yet we're making grade R compulsory, and if it doesn't happen, then someone is going against the law. So I'm interested to see how it's going to be enforced. And I'm also interested to see how they'll get the funding for this issue. It's going to be a real issue. And when schools start again, when there's a new wave of enrollments, the story is going to make the rounds again, and we'll see how the government handles it.
Yeah, so Herman, I mean, this is a, you know, kind of offense that raises the point here. You sort of have passed this decree, and then you have schools that don't have the resources for it. So you sort of are like, well, what are you going to do? Are you going to punish the schools? So does that mean they have to take resources from the, you know, other funding sources to make sure that they have the, you know, that they can host the grade R's and comply with the law? Or are you just going to give them exemptions and say, well, you know, okay, we'll let it slide for now, in which case, what was the point of passing the law? What's your take on this one? I mean, I think, you know, like I said, I think this was kind of in the right direction, but until you get the sort of basics of management correct and value for money, you're not going to make a lot of headway on issues like this.
I mean, it's one of those classic cases about illustrating the pointlessness of a bad law. You can't legislate things into being. Legislation is managerial. It isn't creational. You can't necessarily make something law and then expect reality to sort of align obediently. It reminds me of when Ace Magashule was Secretary General of the ANC, and he said that the ANC, NEC, this was 2019, I think, had decided that unemployment must be brought down to 17%. And I just thought, lovely. Okay, two questions. What does it mean you've decided to bring down unemployment and that unemployment must be brought down? And why 17%? I mean, if you can make these calls, if you can't sort of just rub a lamp or throw salt over your shoulder or whatever, you know, magic lever you can pull, if you can pull it, why decide that 17% unemployment is acceptable? And it just goes to show that there's a fundamental disconnect between what the ANC expects state power to mean. In the best sense, politicians understand that they are policymakers in the sense that they are game rangers. That a game ranger must understand an ecosystem, understand the risks and faults within that ecosystem, and then act within that ecosystem to ensure that the overall system is a bit healthier. Sort of, you can have artificial injections of a bit stronger medicine here at this point, or you can adjust the water supply here. But fundamentally, what you can't do if you're a game ranger is just willy-nilly change something, either in the social economy or in the commercial economy. You can't just decide something must be thus and expect the rest of the system to work. It's like saying, actually, you know what? We need more lions in this part of the park. Okay, let's bring in the lions. Okay, then we've got a situation because the antelope are getting hunted down quicker than they used to. So there's an overgrowing grass issue because the grass isn't being nibbled by the antelope at the rate that it was healthy. That means that you now have bacterial, parasitical, and, you know, sort of vermin sources of oversupply. And then you get sort of rotting trees. Then next moment, the elephants are dying out because you brought in more lions and you didn't quite understand that you're operating within a system that you can't just unilaterally decide something happens. And this is, I think, the fundamental problem with a state-centric view of policy or society, is you think the state can determine human behavior and therefore shape society through behavior. Whilst the realization should be that human nature is of a very specific kind, societies operate in a very specific way, and if you are going to be a sensible governor, you must understand how these things work. And this idea of just saying, boom, compulsory education for grade R, is similar to the constitutional right to housing. It's just because it's on paper, the forces of reality will coalesce accordingly. And it really betrays the poverty of understanding sociologically and in terms of a social economy that these politicians have no clue what drives or doesn't drive the presence of something like grade R within a society. So to just legislate things into being and sort of going, oh dear, that didn't work, is a level of idiocy that can only come in a modern democracy where you have a party so fundamentally out of touch or a political class so fundamentally out of touch as this. Rather than understanding what would have incentivized grade R, they just decided that, you know, bugger the supply side, we're just going to tinker with the demand side. We're going to demand things and the economy will meet up. Not quite understanding that if you want actual reform, it's on the supply side where things must actually happen. So you can't just demand change. So it is truly depressing. She is in an unenviable position, but hopefully, I mean, this could cure some thinking in the political circles that just by writing something onto a paper, getting majority of parliamentarians to say aye, and having the president of the country affix his signature to said document, you don't get reality to behave accordingly just by force of political will. You actually need to understand what the system is that you're investing in.
No, I'm completely on board with that. I was sort of looking around for some of the figures about where South Africa compares actually in the world in terms of how much of its GDP, that's sort of the country's total production per year that it spends on education. And South Africa is pretty high up there. In 2023, we were somewhere around 20th, 30th place in the world in that sort of bracket. We spend somewhere around 6.2% of our GDP on education. That's much higher than countries like France, the United States, Denmark, Estonia, the United Kingdom, South Korea. So obviously they're not a perfect comparison because, you know, those countries, the populations are different, and then there's you know, their economies are big and all that. But the point is that we are spending an awful lot of money, and it's going to be difficult to spend a lot more unless our economy is A, a lot bigger, and B, that the money we do spend is better spent. And I think that is a thing that I return to over and over again with education, is that, you know, there probably isn't enough money to achieve the education goals that we want to achieve. But at the same time, the money we do spend could be spent a lot better.
Absolutely right. But I Robert Rain makes the point that there are differing GDPs, but that's why we relate it to percentage terms, is to give a fair representation of what the government spends relevant to the size of the economy. What frustrates me about this idea is that I think it is completely in the wrong order. I have long grown a terrible, you know, suspicion of anyone who oversells education as a social solution. Education is in time early in a person's life and therefore becomes sort of the basis for a successful career. But just because something is earlier in a normal human life doesn't mean it needs to go earlier in the overall policy diagnosis and cure of a society. Because what you end up having is grade R and early childhood development being run by the state to compensate for the collapse of the family home. And unless we can actually get to a point where families are socioeconomically stable, where we can return to a point where the economy is health, is of such a health that people can provide for their kids, and you know that you can have the necessary spatial outlining of or layout of a sensible economy, that parents can spend time with their kids, you know, until we get to the economy and the consumer base and the parental guidance of a household being sensible, the state can stand on its head and try to make up for the deficiencies of our collapsed home. And Gina Shepherd asked, chicken, egg, where do you begin? You begin with the economy, because it's the thing that you can begin with. You can't begin with the state of grade R education, just make it compulsory, because it can't work. Where you begin is you understand from a governmental policy perspective what are the levers that you can pull to solve societal problems. The government can't go into the morality of parents. It can't dictate how parents should treat their kids at an early age, but it can make the economy more attractive to business, to creating jobs. So you focus on where you can focus as a policymaker and as a governmental official. So it's not, I dispute that it's chicken egg. I think it's very, very clearly where the start should be, because it should be where it can be. And in this sense, everyone in favor of basic grade R education misses the fundamental point that you don't get there with an economy that cannot even provide the socioeconomic stability for a basic household family to survive. So that's the problem with this. It's, you know, more grade R. Yes, fantastic. Why? Oh, because early childhood development is in a crisis. Why? Because the South African household is in a crisis. Why? Because the breadwinners are about as likely to get a job as South Africa is to effectively roll out compulsory grade R education at this stage. You fix that problem, you actually have a positive cascade.
And it's also worth noting that, you know, parents do want their kids to be educated. If they have the resources, they will do it without you having to force them.
There's wonderful historic evidence of this. Black slaves in the postbellum South were constitutionally equal in terms of, you know, the formal law. But in many of the Southern states, you had this sort of petty discounting of these people elevating into proper society. You had laws that made it impossible for the kids of slaves, former slaves, to actually get an education. This is a society you would expect would have no hope of upward socioeconomic momentum, because they were bought and sold as cattle, as beasts. They have no sense of being included in society. If we're going to take the paternalistic view, these people should have been idiotic parents. And yet, to a remarkable degree, They show the ability to understand that the education they never got is important for their kids. So then you end up with Baptist and Methodist preachers being quite often bribed by a slave to go against Southern laws to give their kids an education. And that is a consequence of what? Socioeconomic empowerment. You can't legislate healthy homes. You can only legislate a healthy economy, and healthy homes flow from that.
Vincent, sorry. Anything to add?
Nothing much to add. I will admit, Adaman, it's okay that you came a bit late because you're cooking. You're saying all the right things, and your explanation of where it needs to start, which is just economic growth, it's as simple as it can get. Because like Nick said, if a parent can afford to send a child to school, they'll do it, because we know we need education, and the government making it compulsory is not an enough incentive to be like, hey, maybe I should send my child to grade R or 8, but I can't afford it. So we don't need to be too academic about it as well. It is as straightforward as it can get. Prioritize economic growth, and then everything else will happen by itself, like a multiplier effect, for lack of a better phrase.
So on that note in particular, one of the questions that's so let me back up a bit. You know, we've seen the debate on BEE change in South Africa, I think, over the last year in particular, quite significantly. You know, now even if you go to a sort of center-left publication like the Daily Maverick, you know, they carry lots of center-left opinion. Even there's like kind of articles and things sort of quite seriously considering, you know, is BEE fit to continue. But the pushback always when people like us say, you know, we need to get rid of BEE, is they say, okay, well what's your alternative? What is your alternative? You just want, you always talk about economic growth. You just want this trickle down of wealth. So you just want to basically allow it so that the people who are already ahead to get ahead, and the people who are locked out will stay locked out. And that, you know, you're not really actually giving people who have been systemically discriminated against any kind of leg up. And how do you expect people who are in, you know, desperately searching for food and money to make it to the next day, how are you going to expect those people to be able to invest in themselves and propel things forward? So, Herman, let me go to you. What is the alternative to BEE? What do you say to that criticism of, you know, our calls to abolish such a policy?
Well, the EED system, economic empowerment for the disadvantaged, a system that the IRR has researched and developed over the last decade, and the facts are relatively simple. People overcomplicate things when it's actually not too complex. If we want to make sure that education goes to where it needs to be, that we don't have a situation where the government gets to spend 80% of an education budget on salaries and only 20% on the betterment of South Africa's pupils, well, change how the money is spent. If we want to make sure that parents have a bigger say over their kids' lives than politicians, because politicians have far more sinister motives and incentives, well, let's get the politicians out of the spending structure. So the schooling vouchers, if we're going to link BEE with the education problem, education vouchers are a very simple solution. And I always say it is a solution that should please relatively everyone. It should please the socialists because it's dependent on the state for driving the costs. It's a wonderful taxing and spending opportunity. It should please the libertarians because it gives maximal choice to people within a society, and it should please the pro-growth crowd because it is a proven track record to making sure that the consumer behavior and consumer pressures that led to something like Checkers 60/60 being created and all other grocery retailers now trying to play catch up, it uses those same pressures to solve basic educational problems. It's simple. If the government takes the money it spends currently on public education, and it takes the bulk of that money, transforms it into a fixed amount of vouchers per every pupil, you get to roughly 20,000 Rand. For 20,000 Rand a year, you can buy a stellar education in most instances. So if you then create the resources, the supply side, not the demand side, if you ensure that the supply side is incentivized through market forces by someone, not necessarily with a, you know, a beating heart of saying, oh, I so want to help the poor, but just say, I want to make money, then you are incentivizing people with entrepreneurial skills to enter the educational sphere, enter the educational sector, build a reliable business that can attract as many voucher payments as possible. What you've done in one foul swoop is you've taken corruption out of the system, because no longer do officials through complex bureaucratic processes decide where the money gets spent. You've empowered the parent, the person who cares most about their child. You've inserted pressures into the education sector, making sure that there's actually a competition for who can be better at this game. You've got upward pressure rather than downward pressure for the basic common denominator. And if you apply the same thinking to housing and healthcare, you ensure that you've got a social welfare network funded by the taxpayers, managed in essence by the state, but actually translates into empowerment, because it doesn't only empower through making sure the resources get to those who need them most, but you also allow empowerment through the psychological dignity of choice. The studies showing that people have a higher quality of life if they choose core components of their lives. That's incontrovertible evidence in terms of sociological or psychological perspective. So what's the alternative to PEE? Is it apartheid, as Paul Mashatile tries to have us believe? No. It is effectively saying, how can we make the route from state aid to beneficiary as short, as sweet, as effective, as targeted as possible? And in that sense, vouchers are the way to go. It cuts out corruption to a remarkable degree. It ensures effective spending. It frees market forces. And frankly, it turns people from subjects into citizens, because the difference between a subject and a citizen is choice. So if people come to us and say, well, if not BE, then what? Well, have you tried the basic idea of giving people not a category tick box, but choice and dignity? Well, if not, then you should. And if you should, then you support the Institute's EED program.
So, yeah, as Ofenso said, you are cooking with gas today, Chef Pretorius. Ofenso, you know, it's, I mean, I'd just like any of your thoughts on this in general. But also, you know, my eternal kind of bugbear, the thing that really drives me up the wall about BEE is that, you know, we'll talk about, well, you know, what are the poor supposed to do without BEE? And then exactly the moment that that conversation is no longer being had, the proponents of BEE will turn around and say, but, you know, we really haven't gotten enough senior management positions handed out to politically connected people. You just go, have we not lost the plot here somewhere along the line? I don't know. What's your thoughts on alternatives to BEE?
Yeah, sure. So I have a lot to say on this, but the first where I'll start is the alternative, which is that rather than using skin color as the tool of measurement of who to empower from a government policy, we should rather use socioeconomic status. Whether are we empowering those that are disadvantaged, or are we empowering those that are advantaged but have the right tone of skin? Because we already have these programs that don't use race as a measurement tool. We see this with NASFAS. It funds anyone who earns a certain income, household income. We also get this with social grants. Those who need social grants will get them if they are disadvantaged, and it's not based on race. Those two systems do have their flaws, which is mismanagement. But then now, if we have to shift to BEE, BEE has a flaw of mismanagement, but it's also inherently flawed in its argument, because you can be the likes of Edwin Sodi, but because you have the right skin color, you qualify for BEE, and thus you should win whatever tender that's being thrown out there, despite being advantaged already. But because you're quote-unquote, previously disadvantaged, it doesn't matter how rich you are now, BEE will reward you. That is the fundamental flaw with BEE, and we already are implementing alternatives in other aspects of our government, despite the mismanagement and corruption that those alternatives are facing. Another thing with BEE is its intention. So first of all, it's not empowering the disadvantage that we have explained, but at the same time, when people speak about the managerial positions, it seems as if BEE's goal is to diversify office spaces. But the issue isn't the lack of diversity in office spaces. The issue is that there aren't enough office spaces. We should be creating more jobs, and those, regardless of skin color, they will be in an office, whether they have white colleagues or Indian colleagues or black colleagues. That's neither here nor there. The goal is to get people into work. Thus, going back to what Adnan was saying in the beginning on where to start with all of this, it's economic growth. If the economy is growing at 8% GDP per annum, then and the jobs are being created in relation to that GDP growth, there won't be an issue of, oh no, black people are not being hired in these positions or those positions. If there are that many jobs, and looking at the demographics of South Africa, it's impossible for black people to not be represented, because those are the people that will be employed. One thing as well is that the Business Unity South Africa, BUSA, is challenging the Employment Equity Amendment Act in court. And the one thing that the CEO said is that there's an issue of the supply side. So if the act says, okay, company A needs to hire 100 engineers, that's good and all, but then is the education and training systems producing these engineers that need to be hired? So that's also going back to the need for education. It's going back to the need to prioritize on education as well, but not by just ticking a checkbox in Parliament saying, okay, this grade R is compulsory, but rather to, like Armon said, to give citizens agency to choose and to be empowered as well to make those decisions. And with doing that, plus economic growth, there'll be job creation, and everyone will have access to these jobs that BEE is so allegedly supposed to grant black people. We don't need policy to squeeze in 80% or 90% of the population into 10% of jobs that are available. What we need is more jobs. Once we get that with growth, with prioritization on education, with giving citizens agency, then BEE won't even be needed. It won't be argued for anymore. And we won't get wealth being redistributed amongst the wealthiest while those at the bottom are being left out.
I think I made a joke once that South Africa, it doesn't, if you're growing at 8%, like you'll run out of white people very quickly to monopolize all the wealth, because you just can't have an economy that grows at that scale without expanding opportunity to millions of people who don't have it. As we all know, the colorblind systems that you talked about are completely colonized by the only people who get grant recipients are all middle-class white people. Oh no, wait, that's not true, because those systems help people who are actually poor. Herman, anything to add?
So I think what people must understand about the very pernicious nature of BEE, and people always say, oh, it's just the application of BEE. BEE is good as a policy, but it's just been the application. Okay, let's quickly debunk that. It's not difficult. Let's say we're in a situation where Ofentse and Nick, you're both black. For purposes of this explanation, you're both black. Ofentse, you're from Soweto, relatively poor, just got out of university, let's say, with magically you did well at school, but you're at the very start of your career. You've got no political connections. Nick, let's say you're black and your last name is Mashatile. and you might be related to someone high up in government. I'm a business person. My job, whether I'm black, white, Indian, color, doesn't matter. My job is to find the best value for money and to make money, make profits. I look at two black possible partners here. In my mind, I say to myself, I think we've already got the skills. I'm a white business person. The fact that I have a business means I've got the skills in-house. So offense, I'm really sorry, but you're only bringing your skin color and skills to the table. And I only need one of them. I only need your skin color because the skills we've got in our business, that's how I've been surviving for the last 40 years. Nick, you don't bring skills to this, but you do bring your skin color. But you know what else you bring? You bring political connections. You bring a possible invite to this or that cocktail party. So without any possible corruption, without any illegal application of the BEE system, I have just decided as a sensible business person to go with Nick Mashatile rather than Ofense Davi, because BEE worked in its current moment without any criminality, without any inkling of corrupt practice. We have just empowered an already connected cadre, because the question wasn't, what skill can you bring to my company? I don't need that. I don't want that. I wanted your skin color. And sorry, Ofense, with merit and skin color, that didn't cut it. But political connections and skin color, oh, that is a business plan. That is how you get the patronage access. So when we get this idea that, oh, no, it's only BEE's bad implementation, nonsense, nonsense. It incentivizes exactly the wrong thing. And you know what's the ironic consequence of this little experiment we just ran? Is we are creating, as Thomas Sowell warned we would, within beneficiary classes, an elite beneficiary class smaller than the large beneficiary class. In every instance of affirmative action around the world, this has happened. You couldn't uplift an entire class. You could only carve out a niche class within the larger, whether it's India's Untouchables or South Africa's ANC black elite. The problem with BEE isn't its criminality. It is its very incentivizing of not merit, not value add, but identity and perversion.
Yes, it's essentially a sort of creation of almost an aristocracy, where, you know, you, by being related to people in power, you are yourself become valuable politically and economically.
And Nick, a last thing. Let's quickly say you're not Nick Mashatile, but you are sort of Nick someone else, but you're already in Santon. Let's say you're just a Santonite, not a political connection, and I'm looking for a partner in business. Offense is from Soweto, you're from Santon. Am I going to go with the promising Sowetan entrepreneur? No, I'm not. I'm going to go with a Santonite. So again, it's not black economic empowerment. It is blatant elite enrichment, because it just through its very nature incentivizes the wrong thing, helping those either politically or economically already plugged in. It's telling poor people in Shoshanguve they should feel less poor because someone in Santon with their skin color is now rich.
Well, by that property, Herman, I can claim credit for the marvelous cooking you have just done, by the fact that we share the same skin color. Offense, anything else to add just before we close up for today?
Sure, I'm just going to say a small piece of spectating I did on X. I saw an argument. It was a prominent journalist who I won't name, of course. And there was a debate on BEE on really, the debate was about the inherent flaw of it, of how, whether you're corrupt, as long as you're black, then BEE ought to benefit you. So then in this argument, they raised this journalist a question saying, okay, but what if Edwin Sodi, is competing for a tender against white business owners. And then this person said, morally, the tender should go to Edwin Sodi, despite all the conundrums and scandals and all of the corruption and whatever he's been through. And it goes to how the proponents of the people that champion these affirmative action and redistribution policies, deep down, they have, you know, they want something good. They throw the buzzwords like redress and transformation, and those aren't inherently bad things. So those are noble causes. But along the way, because of the ideology they've adopted, they have lost the true intention of what the goal is, which is to empower poor Black people, not just to empower a person because they are Black. And yeah, I think along the lines, these people that defend BEE have lost the plot. And right now it's a ticking time bomb. People are going to catch up. People are going to be like, hey, I'm Black and I'm poor and I'm not benefiting, but the rich Black people are benefiting. Something is inherently wrong here and something needs to be done, and we need an alternative. It's speaking badly of BEE 15 years ago wasn't as openly accepted as it is now. We see it in a news headline every week, and people are waking up to it. People are waking up to the inherent flaw that is of BEE and affirmative action.
The old cliche that the road to hell is paved with good intentions is a cliche for a reason, which is that it is unfortunately very often true. And so it is in the case of BEE. I know there are many proponents of the policy who really do think that it is the only path towards uplifting the country, but the reality is it is not. It makes life worse for South Africans, not better. And it is not helping. It, in fact, is hurting the very people it is supposed to help. And that's why the sooner we get rid of it, the sooner the country can actually begin to fix the problems of our history. With that, thank you very much, gentlemen, and thank you, everyone, for watching today. We hope you found the show interesting. We will be back next week on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful weekend. Goodbye.